just add that another strong incentive for taking the SC job was, and one that they pushed very hard when I was out there interviewing, was the opportunity to work on a doctorate, which never in my wildest dreams even occurred to me. But I thought, heck, the opportunity's here. I'd probably be foolish if I didn't take it. A full-time faculty member could only take one class per semester. So I did that, a class the first semester, a class the second semester. And then I'd load up every summer. And when I did complete the 4 years, I still had a little classwork to do, and a language exam to pass, and a qualifying exam. So I went back after my first summer in Canyon and finished the coursework. I went back the second summer and took the qualifying exams. It's kind of a misnomer because qualifying sounds like it would become at the beginning of the program, but actually it's the end, and it's one of the biggest hurdles of all. But I got through that. Oh, yeah, and also had to pass the French exam, which was another major hurdle, but I got it done. And
so you finally finished your doctorate there.
Yeah, I finished it in summer. I went out and took the final oral sometime in 1967. It's 1967.
So, again, you followed Ted Krieger to West Texas State University.
I did, yeah. And I thought I was going to be on the same faculty with him, but circumstances dictated otherwise. He left. And so we were without a department head that first semester. And I was a little panicky. I went secure in the knowledge that my good buddy, Ted Krieger, was going to be department head. And now we didn't have one and didn't know who it would be. And so I can't believe I had the temerity to do this. But from L.A., I called Dr. Cornett, the president, and gave him three names of people I thought would be good candidates for that position. This is an audacious thing to do, but I was so young and naive, I didn't realize that. And amazingly, he contacted all three of them. But the only one that responded positively was John Green. John, by this time, was not only the... And we had become good friends, incidentally, over those years in California. And he was, by this time, had become the department head at Long Beach State. So he was sort of a hard sell, but they finally convinced him to come to West Texas. And he got there a semester after I did. He came in January of 1964. And stayed for several years, eventually became dean, and after some years left and went to the University of Mississippi, to Southern Mississippi, rather.
And what year did you retire from West Texas State?
I retired at the end of the summer following the band camp in 2002. So I was there for 49 years.
And you're not finished yet. You're conducting this evening, and you're 84 years old and
yep,
going
and
strong as ever.
I'm leaving at 6 o'clock in the morning to go do a series of clinics in Houston.
Oh, my goodness.
Looking forward to the hour.
The Energizer Bunny, for sure. What changes through the years have you seen, positive and negative?
You mean as far as bands are concerned?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Maybe this just goes with the age. An old curmudgeon looking back and saying, now, my day. But, in my opinion, so much of it was better then. I hate the way marching band is gone. I could go on for a while about that. I think we've lost sight of the fact that the original... The whole idea of the marching band is to provide entertainment for an audience between the two halves of a football game. Not to go out and play the Rite of Spring 7 times a year. But I'll put that aside. Another thing, there have been a lot of good things that happened. You know, when I was a beginning band director, there was no such thing as an assistant. I didn't know anybody had an assistant band director. It didn't exist. And there were no homogenous beginning classes. You just took a whole bunch of beginners, put them in a room. I would have 120 beginners every year. Always just worked out the way. I didn't recruit, but 120 beginners would show up Never would be more than a few one way or the other from that. And so we put them in a room, and I'm teaching everything from, I remember we owned, school owned, four middle alto clarinets. So I always had four beginning middle alto clarinet players. And I consider myself very fortunate that I had to do that. I'm glad I didn't have any assistants, because if those kids were going to learn anything, I'd have to be the ones to show them. So I bought a drum bed and took percussion lessons from Paul Lovett, took horn lessons from J.W. King. And I already played all the woodwinds except for one, and that was bassoon. And I had played extensively, a lot of professional playing. Actually bought a valve trombone to play in the dance band I was playing in so that we could have some four-way trombone things. The tenor sax player and Ted Crager, the trumpet player, also bought valve trombones. We had a really good trombonist already. So we did a lot of four-way trombone stuff. And so I learned how to be a semi-decent valve trombone player, which served me very well, you know, as a teacher. So if these kids were going to learn anything, they had to learn it from me. That meant I had to learn how to do it. I couldn't say, oh, well, talk to your trombone teacher to listen about it. That's your lesson about that. So I think that change has been good for the kids. I'm not sure it's been good for the teachers, though. What I find is most young teachers these days are not terribly well informed when it comes to many other instruments besides their own. But for me personally, as a young teacher, I think that proved to be a great advantage, and I think to this day, I still draw on that experience all the time. To the valve trombone experience, you know. So I was pretty confident about every instrument except bassoon. And the mere sight of a bassoon terrified me because it didn't look like any other thing I could play. So I avoided it as much as I could until one day, and this is early in my career, if I'd started a bassoon player, I did this with Larry Glazner. I handed him a bassoon, the fingering chart, and said, good luck, and that was it. But Larry somehow learned to play, and he really learned to play. Well, he came up to me his eighth grade year. One day, this is another one of those memorable things that I'll never forget, and it was a seminal moment in my career. He said, could I challenge you? I said, what? Well, we had all these challenges going on. I mean, it was a big, big thing. Any student could challenge any other student in their section. Last year, could challenge first year. They could extend a challenge a week. And if the last year beat the first year, he's now first year, and first year is now last year. I don't think that ever happened, but technically it was possible. And so those kids were doing that like mad. And the challenge material was pretty tough. They had to play the chromatic scale for the full range of the horn. And the scale of the week out of the QED book, which is a pretty extensive scale. It wasn't just the scale. Then whatever the challenge material was. And they had to play the scale of the week, by the way, from memory, if it's for the first part. Yum da di 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 dum ba da di 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 dum di 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 dum di di da di da di dum. That's the scale of the week. And so, you know, we'd start off with B flat scale, we just go around a circle of fourths, I think. And after 13 weeks we're back at the B flat scale. So anyway, back to Larry Glazner. Could I challenge you, Larry? What are you talking about? I want to get on in on all the fun. And Mike, who was a second chair player, seventh grader, not anywhere close to Larry, of course, wouldn't challenge him. And Larry felt as if he was really missing out. And I said, Larry, I can't play bassoon. Now, this is word for word. It is word for word. I can't play bassoon. And he said, well, you could learn. And I thought, is this it, God? Is this what you're telling me? Okay. I said, okay, well, Larry, it's going to have to be a while, but we'll do it. So I called my buddy Keith McCarty. He was the clarinet, the woodwind teacher at Texas Tech, the only woodwind teacher they had, clarinet player, and I recently went to his wake. And he was a close family, he and his wife. We were really tight. He's godfather to one of my children. But anyway, I said, Keith, you know anything about bassoon? He said, well, I took a semester of bassoon at the University of Illinois. I said, well, if I came out, would you show me what you know? He said, yeah, sure. It didn't take him very long. He didn't know a whole lot. So, man, I got that bassoon and the fingering chart and what I got from Keith. And I can remember what Larry challenged me on. It was a solo named Pola Chanel. It was a class one solo. And I practiced my heart out. I was practicing 2 or 3 hours a day, every waking hour, and some when I should have been asleep. And so after, I don't know, a few weeks, maybe a month, I said, okay, Larry, I'm ready. So we had a challenge, and I designated, I think, about 3 or 4 of the first chair kids in the band to be the judges with their backs turned. And so we had our challenge. And I was not going to lose, except for one thing. I did. So I challenged him back, man. We had another challenge the next week, and I beat that sucker. But he challenged me, and so helped me the rest of that school year, which was most of the school year. Larry and I had a challenge every week. Well, by the time, and we kind of took turns winning, and by the end of that year, he was one whale of a ninth grade bassoon player, and I wasn't too bad. He was then all state for the following 3 years. He was in high school, and he was just a wonderful kid, by the way. But I owe a great debt to him. I think about him often, and 2 or 3 years ago, that I was thinking about him, I thought, hey, this is the day of the internet. Maybe I could find out where old Larry is. And I did a little search, found out he'd been a lawyer in Leveland, and he had recently died.
Oh, no.
Tears just flowed.
Yeah.
But that, as I said, that was really a seminal moment in my band directing life. And then later on, when I went to USC for my fourth field, you have four fields. Your major, mine was music education. Your second field is music history for everybody. And then a craft field, my craft field was band arranging. And then a fourth field. And mine was woodwind performance. So I took a couple of years of bassoon lessons from Ray Nallen, great Hollywood studio player. A couple of years of oboe from Bill Criss, who was a fabulous Hollywood player. He'd been first chair principal oboe with the Met for 10 years before he moved to California. He was Tabateau's all-time star student. So I learned a world. And then when I got back to Amarillo, I ended up playing bassoon in the Amarillo Symphony for a while. And then finally switched to flute when a flute opening became available. All owing to Larry Glazner. So, you know, again, it's just all those unexpected things. You never see anything like that down the road. They just happen.
Right.
And then as the years go back and you reflect on it, you realize how... What a powerful impact that had on your life.
What advice would you give to young band directors just coming out of school or first or second year directors? What advice would you give them looking back on your career? How could you guide them and save them some agony? Other than what you just said.
Well, there's going to be some agony. Yeah, and you were asking about what changed. You know, so much as... changed a lot of it for the better. Parents have not changed for the better, however. And all the testing and all the paperwork, that's certainly not for the better. But what advice I would give them, I would, first of all, tell them to find as many exemplary role models as they can and pick their brains as much as they can and watch them and see what they do. And I'd also tell them to try to learn to play every confounded instrument they're going to pretend to teach. Otherwise, that's what they'll be doing, is pretending to teach them. And too few do that now. And also, learn to conduct. I'm not sure how to tell them to do that. But in my view, too many of them are, to put it kindly, ineffective conductors. And too many of them have, I'm sure this is not exclusive to current times, too little knowledge. I always compare it to a doctor walking in to do surgery. And he's got a scalpel in one hand and a Gray's Anatomy in the other hand. And he says, appendix, let's see, oh, here it is. It must be about right here. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not prepared to do the job. And the kid raises his hand and says, Mr. Bearden, how do I finger high C sharp on the oboe? You need to have the answer. Hey, kid, you're sharp on that note. Do this. Do that. Do the other. You need to have those answers. And, of course, a lot of that just comes with experience. But the whole thing is, you don't ever quit learning. You never learn at all. And that's one thing that's so great about this job. Every new thing I've ever learned is cause for great jubilation, celebration, excitement. I could go down the list and tell you a million things. The sixth harmonic on the euphonium. Now, I've taught with Don Baird, who's one of my great friends of my life, the late Don Baird, sorry to say. But also a wonderful euphonium player. He was a euphonium soloist at the Army Band at one time. And this is just an example of something you learn. And so I knew the sixth partial was sharp on brass instruments, and it seemed to me it was worse on euphonium almost anything else. So I had sort of secretly, at times, had him use seventh partial fingerings, for example, a high F play at 1 and 2, and it works, mostly, generally. It's better. But I was afraid to tell Don. I figured he'd say, what? You're doing what? And so, finally, one time, I worked up the courage and admitted to him that I'd done it. And he shrugged his shoulders and said, hey, I do it all the time. And he said, but there's a better way if you've got a compensating system. I wasn't even sure what a compensating system was. He said, if you've got a compensating system, he had a Bessin euphonium that he played. He said, you play as an eighth partial. Just use the regular fingerings with the addition of the fourth vowel. And that'll solve your problem. And it does. Well, as it happened, that weekend I was doing an all-region band in Corpus Christi. And we were playing a march. I don't remember what it was, but I had a bunch in the trio. Euphoniums had the melody and had several six partials in it. And as it happened, they all had compensating systems. And I said, euphoniums, if you play that F fourth valve and the E 4 and 2 and the E flat 4 and 1, it'd be a lot better. We worked on it a little bit. It was a lot better, a whole lot better. And I don't know if you ever knew Ferris Arnold, but this is when I met Ferris Arnold. When we took our break, he walked up to me looking at me with just all the admiration you could possibly imagine. He said, wow. I'm a euphonium player, and I didn't know that. And I just shrugged my shoulders and said, well, plenty more I could tell you if I wanted to. What he didn't know is I'd known it about 24 hours. But, you know, that one little trick, and I could go on and name 60 and more, is one you pick up and serves you well.
So tell the youngster about they should have no fear, they should go for it and enjoy the career, and it will be well worth it when they retire.
I wish I could make that blanket statement. There's some people that shouldn't be in this business, you know. There's some people that shouldn't be doctors or lawyers or whatever. And there's certainly some people that shouldn't be band directors. My good friend and former department head and longtime band director, Harry Haynes, and I have discussed this endlessly. Exactly what are the qualities that are going to lead to success as a band director? And what we both finally mutually decided was the number one thing, not musicianship, not even knowledge, is personality. And if you can't relate to the kids and they relate to you and you establish a learning atmosphere, doesn't matter how much you know, it ain't going to happen. It's got to start there. And then if that does happen, then all the knowledge and musicianship that you can bring to bear, that's when that really enters the picture. But I've known, you have too, I'm sure, a lot of good musicians that were perfectly lousy teachers. So if you don't have that, whatever that quality is, and I use the word personality for lack of a better one, But whatever that elusive quality is, if a person doesn't have it, then I think that's the time to start looking elsewhere for employment.